All right, I'm Clara Ortega. Today is August 14th, and I'm here with Valerie George, and we're here for the Samuel Proctor Oral History Project with the Punk Project. And Valerie, can you introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Valerie George. I am originally from Atmore, Alabama, but live in Pensacola, Florida. And I am one of the members of the 309 Punk Museum Project, in which we are trying to, as a collective group, save an historic punk house. It's arguably one of the oldest punk houses in the South, operating since the late 80s, which we can document. And it's located on 309 North 6th Street in Pensacola, Florida. And it's currently up for sale, and we are trying to buy it.
All right.
It's giving me some sort of...
It is.
I think it might have just been clipping a little bit.
Okay.
Oh, my goodness. I was loud.
It's just really sensitive.
Mm.
Okay. So can you tell us about how you got involved in punk?
Sure. It's kind of an older, weird little story, I suppose. I grew up in a small rural town called Atmore, Alabama, and went through high school in the early 90s. And in high school and in Alabama, in Atmore, Alabama, and specifically, there were about four people who identified themselves as punks. And I found myself gravitating towards them because I certainly didn't feel comfortable or normal hanging out with anyone else. So I wasn't quite sure what punk stuff was all about. They had... there were just a group of people who were kind of fun and out there, and we were all poor. It was very much like a social class experience for sure, and we didn't have a whole lot of supervision. We didn't have a whole lot of family structure, and we had very little money and very little to do. So we found ourselves sitting around record players and listening to music. And sort of running around together and learning how to skate and learning how to play really crappy instruments that people would give us. And we just started, you know, our lives as little tiny baby punks. And as we got a little bit older, we decided we wanted to move out of the small town. So a lot of us, there was a band that had formed in Pensacola out of this core group called Jim Crack. And that band moved to Pensacola. I wasn't in the band, but I was dating one of the guys that was, and we all moved here, and we were very well received by the punks that were here, and it just made sense that we moved right into this scene, and particularly the people at 309 were really nice to us and hung out, gave us, you know, cool ideas about where we can have shows and just sort of how to fit in. And we found our own little scene within punk, Pensacola punk, and believe it or not, it's quite a large scene. There's like a bunch of people on the west side, there's a bunch of people on the east side, there were a bunch of kids out in Milton and Cantonment and just all over, so we just found our niche and sort of spun around with the crew that was here, and that was in the 90s. And I moved away to California and lived in a few punk houses in California and went to graduate school. And then came back and moved into a punk house right down the street from 309. I lived in the Javelin Joint, which was located on Garden Street. And it was great. Lots of awesome bands played. That was in the early 2000s. And probably the most memorable house show was Matt and Kim came through and played in our living room, which was super fun. But tons of bands played. Red Wizard, just all kinds of great bands. And I eventually moved out of that punk house and moved into a warehouse alone, and I've sort of not gone back to the punk house life. Mm-hmm. But because 309 was such a rich part of my history and in my early teens and early 20s, and then again when I moved back here in my 30s, it made sense for me to say yes when Scotty Satterwhite asked if I would help this project and like get on board and see if we couldn't raise the money to buy this house.
Cool.
Yeah, so that's where we are now, is desperately raising money to try and buy this house. As if we don't buy it, it's likely to be knocked down, and that area has gentrified tremendously. Mm-hmm. And Pensacola has changed dramatically in terms of housing, and there's virtually no place for lower income creative people who are choosing a lifestyle of a lower income so they can be creative. Mm-hmm. There's not many places left for people like that to live. And it is a shame. It does squelch the creativity of the scene. So,
Can you tell me a little bit about what life is like living in the Javelin Joint? Just like generally living in a punk house?
Mm-hmm. Well, you really definitely have to like have your reasons to be there, I think. And I did. I loved music and being around people who kept odd hours. I was teaching college at the time, weirdly, believe it or not. And but for me, I was a late nighter always, and I preferred being around an active scene and around activity in general. And so for me, the Javelin Joint was wonderful because it was just full of people who were also either, I mean, these are not lazy people. These were people who were like, had multiple jobs, had lots of activities that they wanted to like coordinate and secure. It was very community driven. Ryan Greensboro, that sort of was like, I don't know, he sort of kept Javelin Joint together. He worked at Slogo's, which was the main punk restaurant slash venue space for years and years here. And what he did on the side of that was organize these huge bike polo tournaments, which is from all, kids would come from all over the country to play bike polo, and they're usually a bunch of dirty punks too. And so, you know, there were always people coming through, crashing with us for that. Always bands coming through, crashing. Of course, it's owned by a slumlord, so we very rarely had functioning hot water. We lived with a gray water system under the like bathroom sink forever because the landlords would not come and fix the pipes. And we didn't really mind that much. I mean, we dealt with it, but eventually it became a little much for me personally, but I still know people who live that way quite comfortably, and some by choice. So that was really interesting. And the woman that was living in the back of the house with us was going to college to become, she wanted to become a reporter. And she was also the lead singer of like this really incredible metal band that was in town. And she was just incredible to like hang out with and talk to. And we eventually moved out together. So like it was just this wonderful space of community and creativity and action. And you never knew who was going to be sleeping on the couch on the porch or who was going to be sleeping on the floor in the hall. But it was always a really like open community, lots of food flowing, vegetarian, vegan food flowing. Like our scene's pretty politically active. Not all punk scenes are, but ours is. And so lots of people who are vegan and vegetarian politically by choice. So that kind of spirit was certainly floating around a lot, mm-hmm. You know.
Yeah. So I think like it'd be kind of interesting to talk about like the changing nature of the punk scene in Pensacola, because mm-hmm. a lot of the places that you're talking about, I think, aren't here anymore.
Yeah.
Like Slogo's especially.
Yes.
I mean, is what I think of because that's where I went in high school.
Yeah, exactly.
So how do you think that like affects just generally like the punk scene?
Well, it's huge, you know. Sort of the beauty and the sadness of being a punk generally has to come from like, I can't speak for all punks, but I'll speak for myself, and I do believe this had something to do with Slogo's, but we're self-made people. And like I said, a lot of us like gravitate towards each other because our family structures maybe aren't as strong as others. And so we have to find our family elsewhere. At least that was my experience. And in terms of education, you know, nobody asked me to go to school. Nobody asked me to stay in school. I had to make that choice myself, and I had to fund it myself, and I had to figure it out. And some of us went that route and some of us didn't. And those of us that didn't go to school were really creative in our DIY skills, and we tried to like cobble lives together for ourselves and businesses together for ourselves and ways to financially to support ourselves because we had to. And I think Terry Johnson did that. She had no business skills or training. She didn't go to college for any of it. You know, she was a self-made punk out of a pretty poor family, and she just knew a little bit about it because her mom ran a bar or a liquor store. I'm not sure if it was ever a bar, but I know she had a liquor store. And so Terry like had some basic understanding just by growing up in it. But you know, at that same time, it's hard to run a business that was as strong as Lego's mm-hmm. and keep food in the stocked in the fridge and beer in the fridge. And you know, it was quite often that people, you know, worked and didn't get paid, and that you went in there and wanted a beer and they wouldn't have it. There would be nothing there. So like, unfortunately, like it met its own demise, and that is heartbreaking. But I think it was mainly like there were so many odds stacked against Sluggos at the end of the day because they had gotten a spot on Main, you know, downtown Pensacola. And at this point in Pensacola's history, it's nobody wants much grubby punks there. 20 years ago, it was hard to stay there when there was nothing on the block. Mm-hmm. And now that it's gentrifying and it's growing, and Debbie Dunlap is still around trying to push people off of downtown, you know, Pensacola blocks, like, mm-hmm. it was really difficult for them to stay there, from my understanding. I feel like they were literally, like, shoved out. And what that does to a scene, well, luckily our scene is strong and beautiful and awesome, and the punks will find a place to go, and then we'll find somewhere to be, and they did. And so a new generation of house shows started popping up, like Ground Zero is where Surrounder lives, and another, you know, house right behind them. They have house shows there, and Shizuko luckily popped up. I don't think it was planned. It's not the same people as Sluggos, but mm-hmm. A lot of the same punks like went to work in the restaurant because they decided to keep it vegan. Mm-hmm. And that's a show space for the scene. And there's another band in town called Dead Bugs, and these kids, they literally bought a house. I don't know how they did it. But a bunch of them got together, bought a house, and now there's a punk house that they own, and they can do whatever they want. Mm-hmm. And they've got ramps out back, and there are girls learning how to skate, and it's badass, and it's a really awesome community of really young people who are supporting each other. It's mm-hmm. really awesome.
That is awesome.
Yeah. So I think I answered your question, but essentially, gentrification is really making it difficult for yeah. anybody who's creative and wants a different lifestyle outside of like traditional capitalist existence. Mm-hmm. Making it very difficult to do that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk maybe a little bit more about how like the political ideas of the scene in Pensacola?
I mean, I could try. I don't, mm-hmm. I was gone for a great deal of a lot of the politically active groups, and Scotty's really going to be a better person to talk to about that. Mm-hmm. What I witnessed back in the day had to do with, you know, mostly politics around food and politics around the body. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of like talk of inclusion in terms of gay rights. And that was like a really hard language back in the 90s for essentially rural Alabama. I mean, I know we're in Florida, but it's pretty tough. But it was a great scene in which people really, really stayed open. But there was still a lot of sexism within the scene, too. Don't get me wrong. Yeah. And there still is. But it's not everywhere, for sure, the way it used to be.
Do you feel like the sexism has ever affected you personally?
Oh, sure. I mean, like, even when I was a young girl in Atmore, like, it's not that the guys that I were hanging out with were sexist jerks or thought them... I didn't think of them that way, and they didn't think of themselves that way. Mm-hmm. But just the overarching notion that it never occurred to me to pick up an instrument and mm-hmm. start a band, mm-hmm. because that's what the boys did. It was just like this understanding that that was not for me. Mm-hmm. And, but I mean, honestly, the guys that were with it, they tried. They were like, hey, you want to play this? Like, they wanted to give it to us and to give us instruments, and they would spend time with us and teach us how to play them. Because the dudes that we hung out with weren't assholes, but like there was just a broader sort of pressure that I felt like the confidence wasn't in me. But I was also a teenager and in my 20s, and by the time I was in my late 20s, early 30s, I was in bands and playing drums and all that stuff. So that like wore off. But I mean, even to this day, like in this project, I have many opportunities where I'm out in the world, and I still feel like people look to the male standing next to me to like ask me questions about what it is that we're doing.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting. Like there are some people who just won't look me in the eye or think that I have anything to say that's worthy because I'm a girl. So mm-hmm. what do I know? Of course, at this point, I'm a 43-year-old woman, and I know quite a bit. So they're clearly missing out. But, you know, it's still there.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's still there.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. So what now does punk look for you as, like, a 43-year-old woman?
It's more fun than it's ever been. I mean, I am currently not in a band. But my role in the scene has more to do with being part of being an archivist, just archiving what's been around, what's happening, and sort of really examining it and really paying, like, giving credit where credit's due. Like, there are a lot of people in Pensacola that have done some incredible things for the scene. And when the scene is rich and strong, then the people who are in it are richer and stronger. And so we're just, I just sort of see my role as like someone, as an older generation punk, like someone that just is there to support the younger generation. And I particularly, you know, keep my eyes out for the young women because that's who I want to see, you know, have a little bit of strength and support. And so when I see a girl in the audience with a camera, I'm like, keep taking those pictures, you know, like, you know, take pictures of what you love. I just encourage them when I see them doing things that make them happy, when I see women in bands, and also like the gay and transgender community here is really growing and it's awesome. So the queer scene's really great, and it's really important to me to like support them as well, because there's plenty of support for the guys, you know, and there are very few people of color in our scene, but they're there, and we're trying to like just keep the scene as rich and beautiful and open as possible. So I think our job as the older punks is to just educate people on openness and acceptance, and like everybody's going to define punk for themselves and like what that means for themselves. And my definition has certainly changed over the years, but I will share it with them whenever they ask me. But for me, it really is just like supporting each other and like keeping your arms open and your mind open. And when people need you, like, be there, show up, step up.
That's great. Yeah.
Yeah.
So going back a little bit, is there like any story behind like maybe your, how you learned how to play drums or your first band?
Sure. That's a good one, actually. I learned how to play drums when I turned 30. It was a birthday present to myself. Mm-hmm. I had moved back to Pensacola and I didn't know anyone anymore because except for like maybe a handful of people that were still around. And I had got a job at the university teaching sculpture, and I had left all my friends in San Francisco and left, you know, all of that. And I was just like, okay, I don't really fit in at the university. I kind of felt like an outsider there. All of my colleagues there were much, much older and into a different scene. And so the first thing I did was went to Sluggo's, and they were doing sort of like a rock fight kind of thing where they would just like put people's names in hats and like you could draw yourself a band of like total strangers. And I didn't do that, but I was really inspired by that because what I saw was that there were guys, girls, older people. Terry Johnson was in her 40s at the time. And I was sort of weirded out and thinking that everybody around me would be ageist around this 30-year-old woman coming into a scene of 20-year-old people. But Terry Johnson was like up on that stage with the 20-year-old folks and like everybody was jamming out and doing this awesome stuff. So I went to Teddy, who is the drummer for This Bike Is a Pipe Bomb, and because I knew he had a drum set here in town at Terry's house, and I asked him if I could borrow them for a while because they were just sitting there. And he said, of course. And so I learned how to play on the coolest drum set in the world in my living room by myself, and eventually started a band with this guy named Stephen Hyde, who that's his guitar, who is now the cyclocross champion of the world, of the United States. He's amazing, total badass. He was the guitar player. He started out as just a little BMX dirty punk guy and worked his way up. But anyway, a man named Zach, who also played guitar, and a good friend, Anthony Halavity, who played bass. And our band was called Cuddle Puddle. And we were a really heavy shoegaze band. Yeah, and they were all 20 years old, and I was 30 years old, and they called me Mama Val. And that's the way it went. And we had a really fun little stint there.
Awesome.
And I was in several bands after that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that was my first, like, real awesome, fun experience playing.
Was touring part of your, like, experience in a band at all?
I did a different thing with touring because I'm a visual artist and an aural artist. I really like sound and noise and all of that good stuff. When the band that I really cared about broke up, it was hard for me to, like, find that again. But I was also like under a lot of pressure from myself to like make more visual art. And so I came up with this idea to put a drum kit on the roof rack of my car. Mm-hmm. And so I could drive it through the rain and let the rain play the drums.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And it was fun. And so I did that. And then I figured out how to like mic it and record it. So I built this recording studio in the back of the car. It was a big 83 station wagon.
Wow.
Mercedes station wagon. And whenever I built it, I kind of stood back and I was like, shit, I just made an instrument. I just made this really cool thing that like I could drive around the country in and like record stuff with people. And so that's how touring sort of worked out for me. I like booked these tours where I would drive around the country and go meet up with an artist or a visual or a sound or a noise person, and we take the car out to some beautiful place out in the natural whatever and make a song with the car. And that was sort of how I got like really deep into the punk scene, because it's all like word of mouth and just people who are willing to do something weird like that.
Yeah.
And I put out all those songs on my own label and made a bunch of tapes and yeah, so that's how touring looked for me.
That's really
cool. But it took me all over the country.
Yeah.
So it was really incredible.
Any like particularly memorable experiences?
All of them were. But I mean, the very first song I recorded was with Ry Modee from Pipe Bomb. He was up in Chattanooga. And I stopped there and picked him up, and Anthony Halabity from the first band was with me. And we like drove up to the top of a mountain and we recorded the song that he had written. But when we got to the top of the mountain, we pulled over to the side of the dirt road and we got stuck on the mountain. But we recorded the song anyway, and then we packed everything up, and then we like pushed, you know, the car sort of tried to get the car out of it, but we were like really pushing on this like bumper that's been on this car since 1983 when it was built, right? And so we couldn't get it out, and tow truck came. I don't even know how we got cell phone service to make it happen. This is like 2010. And then I keep on going down the road and I end up in New York City, and I've got a carload of like super drunk punks in the back seat. And in the back of the car, we're driving down the street in New York City, and the bumper literally falls off.
Oh my God.
And so it's like dragging behind the car because there's like a, you know, an electrical light to you know, electrical cord to like operate the lights on the bumper. So the bumper's just like dragging, sparks are going crazy, and there are all these like drunk punks in the back like, what the hell's going on? And one guy just like leans out and brings it in. It was a mess. So that was part of it. Yeah, that was a fun one. Yeah. Everybody's fine. But stuff like that.
Yeah.
A miracle we made it around the country in that crappy old car.
And what was the name of that project?
Namjoon Pike.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And how'd you choose that name?
So Namjoon Pike is a very famous videographer and noisemaker from the 70s and 80s. He was probably one of the more seminal video artists, and I've always been an extreme fan of his work.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a student who was really into noise. His name is Stu. His band name was Balderdash. We actually collaborated a lot. And he just texts me in the middle of the night. He's like, you need to be Namjoon Psych. And I was like, yeah, I do. That sounds really great.
That's cool.
And so Stu did it.
That's awesome.
Yeah, really awesome.
Cool.
So I've been very lucky because I teach in the art department. I have lots of wonderful people to like learn from and learn with, and mm-hmm. also share what I know, and it's been really fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think the DIY ethic has like influenced how you teach?
Definitely.
Cool.
Being a punk growing up as a punk, growing up poor, being problem solver, understanding that, you know, it's up to me ultimately at the end of the day, but there's always somebody around to support you if you'll let yourself be supported.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all of that stuff I learned from punk culture, for sure.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Let's see. Well, so right now I think you're immersed in like the 309.
Yes.
Punk house project. Can mm-hmm. you tell us a little bit more about like what that is?
Yeah, well, originally, like I said, it started with Scotty and Terry Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
Christopher Satterwhite, we call him Scotty, and Terry Johnson. They lived in 309 for years and years and years, and of course they both moved out, but the punks have lived there since, you know, the late 80s or the 80s, and there's still a bunch of punks that live there now. And it's in extreme disarray, and the landlords haven't put any money into it in 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
And literally the toilet's about to fall through the floor.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's bad. It's very bad, and it's dangerous. And there's a person that's living there now that needs to live there. Like, he just needs to be close to work. He needs to be able to walk to work. He doesn't drive. And he's in one of the one of the most important punk bands in town. It's called Resolve. His name is Barrett Williamson. And his partner, Lyric, lives there with him. And one of the members of his band, Zach Spiker, lives there as well. Mm-hmm. Spilker? Spiker? I'm not sure of his last name. And we just realized that, you know, Terry and Scotty realized that something needs to be done. It's like it needs to, we need to save this house. Like, these guys need a place to live. But we can't really raise $300,000 from strangers to be like, we need to like put, we need to keep this house so these folks can live here. Like, that's, it needs to be more than that. And we want it to be more than that. And so what we have come up with is this idea that if we can buy the house will still remain as a living punk house, but part of the house, it's a big giant two-story house, part of the house could operate as an artist in residence. So like touring punks could come through and live there and make art for like a couple of months. We can do a show for them and then they could move on and we'll get another crew in. Mm-hmm. It functions very much like an artist in residence. I've done several of them, so the model doesn't frighten me at all. It's, mm-hmm. it's quite a lovely model. And then another room could serve as the archive because we have been collecting so much punk memorabilia from an ephemera from Pensacola. And also we have a dream to start a label so we can like have an affordable record label for all the kids here in Pensacola to like record their stuff and get their heart out there in the world and their creative stuff. So the goal is to raise awareness of the importance of punk culture and like what punk culture brings to Pensacola and what it's brought all these years. And what it's brought is very tangible and very countable. You know, mm-hmm. you can see it all over this town. You can see it in the vegan restaurants. You can see it in the political exchanges. You can see it in attitudes. You can see it in, you know, one of the largest like queer scenes in this area. You know, it's here for a reason. And that reason is that punks have been here to welcome it and to foster it. And that's really huge. So to go back to answer your question, because I'm rambling, I'm sorry. we're just really trying to, we really sat on, you know, what would people donate money for us to do? Mm-hmm. And what do we want to do? And what is actually valuable? And so really keeping it as a community space is what's valuable. And that is the goal at the moment. Since we don't own it, we have to operate essentially as a collective. So the 309 Punk Museum project mm-hmm. is us operating outside of a brick and mortar space, collecting all of this ephemera and trying to curate exhibitions that are educational and interesting and fun, like the one at the T.T. Wentmore. Mm-hmm. But also like making new art out of that archive that is also educational and fun and cool. So, you know, we've done things like paint the mural of all the Pensacola punk tattoos that's on the cubes outside of the Wentworth. We've been invited to do another show in Mobile. I think people are really responding to what we're doing. And then we're doing a lot of like just community outreach, like zine workshops and screen printing workshops and educational fun things so people can like learn how to make things by themselves, like this sort of DIY like approach. Just sharing that knowledge, keeping people excited, that kind of thing. So that's what we've been able to do so far. We certainly have not raised anywhere near $300,000. But we are now officially a nonprofit and we're still writing for grants and things like that. So.
That's awesome. Yeah.
see how it goes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Pensacola, obviously, like you said earlier, is basically Alabama.
Yeah.
And like, how have you seen that influence like the music scene here generally?
Well, I think the most beautiful thing is just the sound of the South, you know, like mm-hmm. Pipe Bomb is known as being like the first folk punk band. And that's because we're all raised on hymns and country music. I mean, it's everywhere and I love it, and there's nothing wrong with loving it. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of punks that absolutely identify with it. We call them crunchies, mm-hmm. crunchy punks. But yeah, I mean, like my record collection's full of Willie and Dolly and Johnny Cash and all that stuff. And we're completely aware of the richness of that sound. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of punks naturally borrowed it. So the folk punk thing is kind of originated here in a way. It's a bold statement, but I think it's I think it's there's some truth in it. And you know, when I think about Against Me, it's not super far away either, and sort of the way they evolved and the way their music sounds. Mm-hmm. But then, of course, there are bands here that don't sound anything like that. And if they've been influenced at all, I look at Surrounder. I think they've been influenced by the politics of the South. So you would hear that in their lyrics and not necessarily in the sound of the music. Mm-hmm. So, like, not to say that we don't have plenty of just, like, silly, fun punk bands that just play and sing about silly things and they're just here for fun and joy. But there's something very beautiful in punk about that, too. You know, not many people relish and do things just for fun. There's usually a dollar bill or a dollar sign around it. So yeah. It's kind of wonderful. You have to sort of see that too as precious. And I think there's that as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I've kind of like had this experience in the music scene. I wonder if this is how you feel too, but I think mm-hmm. in Pensacola, I found that like punk is more of like an ideology and less like a sound to the music. Would you agree with that? Do you have any thoughts on that?
I mean, this is just me personally. I think so. I think I know punks that don't look like punks. Mm-hmm. And that is to me because they live and breathe a particular kind of way. I think it has more to do with an ideology than it has to do with music, but music certainly comes out of that ideology. Mm-hmm. And, but I mean, there are some people that the only way that they know punk is because it has a particular sound mm-hmm. and they think that's what punk is. And that is what punk is to them, you know, but I don't think I look like a punk. I have all the tattoos and the markings and all of that stuff, but I'm also, you know, I feel like I am very much punk, but I don't know that people would pick me out of a crowd and say, that person is a punk.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it definitely seems like attitude, ideology, spirit, motive, drive, what makes them tick mm-hmm. has more to do with it. Yeah.
Yeah. So going way back, whenever you were living in Atmore, was mm-hmm. it? Was there like a music scene out there? Because you said there were only like four other people.
No, we didn't have a scene. I mean, this is before the internet, you know. We got records because we got this mailing. We got Maximum Rock and Roll through the mail. Mm-hmm. And in Maximum Rock and Roll, the magazine, there was places where you could order records. And one of the places where I ordered all mine was called The Blacklist, and it was out of San Francisco. And so I would write Blacklist and send cash in an envelope and check a box for whatever record I wanted. And it would show up in the mail, and so the four or five of us would be really pumped about that and be like, the Blacklist came in, and everybody would just jump around the record player and sit around, and we'd listen to the record from back and front over and over and over again and like sit and actually have listening parties. We didn't call them that, but that's what we did. And mm-hmm. we just would sit and smoke cigarettes and listen to 24-hour Revenge Therapy on repeat, you know, or whatever had come through. So that was more of the scene. But we would load up and come to Pensacola and see shows. particularly at the Night Owl, because they were all ages shows. So we were going to see those. And Jim Crackwood's a really great band, and they've got albums and, you know, 7 inches. And they were headed up by Scott Bryant, who has passed away at this point. But Scott was a very driven individual, and, you know, at 17 years old, he had booked tours and shows, and Jim Crack went everywhere. So they were amazing. And a band named Hinge that he was also in, and later they became, like, New Broadcast, and just, he was in tons of bands. So Pensacola was the scene. Yeah. There were just a few of us who, you know, hung out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's cool that, like, Pensacola has just been there.
It's just been there. I know. So long. And way before me, I'm finding that there was a guy named David McWiggin. When he was 19 years old, he opened McWiggin's Speakeasy in 1979.
Wow.
And was like, it's probably one of the first punk show venues. Mm-hmm. And it was on Palafox. And it closed in 82. But his dad, whose name was Yank, helped him open it. And, like, there were tons of bands that were, like, really heavily influenced by the Ramones. And they eventually got the Ramones down here and played at Destin.
Wow.
There are pictures of Johnny and Joey Ramone on their Facebook page right now. It's awesome.
That's amazing.
It's amazing. And hanging out with kids from McWiggin's. And there are all these photographs of the inside of the Speakeasy. And you can just see, like, their graffiti scrawls, like the Vapors, and like all these bands that were really popular in New York at the time. People were in Pensacola, like, losing their minds, like, because they had to go find that stuff too. It's not like they were playing the Ramones on the radio yet. Mm-hmm. And so these are people who are, I don't know how they got their records. I don't know where they got this stuff, you know, because it was hard enough for us to get it in the 90s. I don't know where the hell you got it in the 70s. Guess in the record stores. But, yeah, it's amazing. The photographs are insane. Mm-hmm. It looks like CBGB's, but it's here.
Yeah.
You know?
That's wild.
Bananas. So it's really awesome to, like, know that that spirit's really been pumping through Pensacola veins for a while, mm-hmm. you know? And I think it's a kind of, it's got to be everywhere, but because we're digging in, we're starting to find it everywhere. And that's really kind of cool.
Yeah, that is really cool. Was it different whenever you were living in California?
It was a different kind of scene.
Yeah.
I mean, California in general, like, it's just a different world.
Yeah.
I mean, I was in the Bay Area, and I was in, at the time I was in grad school, so, and I was at a tier one institution, just like in Gainesville. So, like, the caliber of people around me all of the time, I'm not going to say that they were all rich or came from, like, a more privileged financial background, but certainly a little bit more privileged in terms of, like, they just sort of were more worldly.
Mm-hmm.
And they could just get their hands on shit. But that I hadn't seen before in a way that I hadn't seen before. But they also just looked different. You know, like, we were always sweaty and dirty and smelly and always wearing black. And out on the West Coast, you know, it wasn't quite so much like that. Not as much like dirty bike punks. They were always had like a bit of more fashion. A little bit more fashionable. But fucking just as sweet, just as great. It was a very good scene. I booked a lot of shows there
mm-hmm.
with the guy I was dating at the time. And just, it was also great. It was just different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how long were you there?
It was like 99 through 2006. I think I can move back here in 2006.
Yeah. Did you always plan on moving back here, or did you just...
Oh, hell no. No. My brother was ill,
mm-hmm.
Was dying, mm-hmm. and I had to come home. Mm-hmm. And I knew I needed to be home for a while, and so I applied for
a job at the university, not really expecting to get, I just expected to adjunct and like just kind of piddle around for a minute.
Yeah.
And then they offered me like a real job. And those don't really get flown at you in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was working at a real Kochek at a very shitty bar in San Francisco with a $60,000 degree, you know,
yeah.
that I needed to pay for. And it was much more difficult to go back to San Francisco and get what they were offering me. And I resented it at first, but I, in retrospect, realized it was like one of the most wonderful things ever.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't have been able to teach myself how to play drums in my apartment in San Francisco. I would not have been able to like put drums in a roof rack on my car and drive it through a hurricane. And none of those things would have happened. And I wouldn't have landed in Tape Op magazine. I wouldn't have landed in Tom Tom magazine. None of these things would have happened had I stayed in San Francisco
yeah.
and kept working Kochek and let my self-esteem kind of go down the drain of that shitty bathroom in North Beach. So like, coming back here, this scene, like, really picked me up,
mm-hmm.
and it's very good stuff.
Yeah.
Don't regret it at all.
Yeah. What does, like, scene support look like for you?
Like, it's just smiling, man. I mean, I don't know, like, these... I know...
story.
Yeah, I know that there's, like... I know that there's shit in the scene. Like, there's always gonna be people who do bad things. There are gonna be people that aren't cool, who are doing something shitty, who have done something shitty. There's always gonna be drama. I see that, but this is a community, and that's what it looks like. And there's it's a family, and that's what it looks like. There's always gonna be some kind of drama. But for me, the way I felt support was like, absolute acceptance, like zero ageism crap, zero, you know, sexist crap by the scene. Mm-hmm. If I got sexist or ageist stuff, it was not in our scene. It was outside of that. And just like, it didn't matter how shitty I was at any instrument. People just wanted to come and stand in front of you and like smile on your face and spill beer all over it. And have a good time. And I just was always just felt like people just wanted to support other people doing their thing. That's all I ever got from it.
Mm-hmm.
Really and truly. It was just really strong. And whenever I needed people, they showed up. And they just keep showing up.
Yeah. That's really cool.
Yeah. No, I feel lucky. Did I answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay.
do you have any, like, I don't know, crazy stories from being a punk? I feel like everyone who has been a punk music scene probably does.
I mean, the weird thing was is... I'm sure if you ask the right person if I described any of my life, they'd think it was pretty crazy. But I'm really used to it.
Yeah.
So it's pretty common to, you know, watch people get piercings in a bathroom with a safety pin and an ice. it's pretty common. You know, we did everything ourselves, so it was just sort of common to watch people build loft beds in their room and stack people three deep.
Mm-hmm.
As long as there were room for the records underneath the bed, everything was cool, you know? Like, I think, like, the craziest stories are just really, like, more to do with how beautiful it is.
Yeah.
Like, that it works and that it keeps working. That it sort of weirdly saves people's lives,
mm-hmm.
you know? And, like, you don't even realize how much it means to just be there at the right time and go to a show and just step in the way and protect somebody if it gets a little rowdy, or just stand next to somebody who looks shy and introverted and weird and just be like, what's up, dude? How you doing? You know, like, just talk to them. Like, all anybody is looking for is, like, connection and support. And if you recognize the scene as being that, it's mm-hmm. really easy. It's just really easy to be there for people. Mm-hmm. So I just think that's the craziest thing. It's just, like, how beautiful a bunch of, like, people can be. And that's really the sweetest part. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, that's really, that's a really nice answer. I like that.
Good. Anything else you can think of?
Not that I can think of. Is there anything else that you feel like we haven't touched on?
No, I can't think of anything. I really do want you to talk to Scotty. He can really talk to you about all the political stuff, and that's mm-hmm. really exciting.
Yeah.
He's got his finger on the pulse of all of that.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I'm more on the creative side of the scene mm-hmm. and, you know, just sort of more interested in that for myself, because that's what my career is and how I, like, participate. But Scotty, I think, is can talk to you more about the rest of it, because it's such a rich scene. Mm-hmm.
Cool. Well, yeah. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. That was fun.
Yeah.